Welcome to Broad Appeal, the podcast that looks back at female-driven films from the not-so-distant past. I'm Sean.
And I'm Brian.
How you doing, Brian?
Well, Sean, I'm marveling at your enunciation of our standard boilerplate, but I'm hoping that you're still feeling as you usually are.
Yes, super as always.
And I'm marveling because you and I have been listening to quite a lot of enunciation recently, haven't we?
And indeed we have.
Why is that, Sean? Can you explain to our constituents?
Dear listener, if this irritates you already, please just turn it off
now. No, don't turn it off.
Today, Brian, we are talking about Glenda Jackson.
Yes, Tony nominee Glenda Jackson.
Yeah. By the time this goes out, she will be still a Tony nominee.
Yes. Glenda Jackson is having a legitimate moment, right? For an 80-year-old actress.
82.
82-year-old actress, who's already won 2 Academy Awards, who's had an entire other career.
And an Olivier.
She's not going quietly into that good night, you know?
No, she is crawling back from the depths of hell.
So I'm sure we're going to talk about our own experiences with Glenda. Those of you who are lucky enough to be in New York can see her on stage now with Laurie Metcalf.
Or, if you lived in Hampstead and Highgate between the years 1992 and 2015, you were lucky enough to have her as your MP.
Oh my god, what would you have given, Sean, to be able to have Glenda as your MP?
I would have given her my vote.
You know, it's funny though, I don't know if we've ever mentioned this on the podcast, our MP, we live in Brixton, but the constituency is called Dulwich and
it's
West North.
It's gerrymandering, Brian.
Yes, yes. But our MP is also an Oscar winner.
Yes, it's Academy Award winner Helen Hayes.
That's right. She just happens to be named Helen Hayes. Same name as, of course, the late Oscar-winning actress. Also, I think, a 2-time winner. Yes?
I don't know.
I have to check that.
All I know is that she was an airplane.
She was.
Airport.
Airport, yes. So much of the current coverage of Glenda Jackson definitely has to do with this idea of her return from the political career to the acting career. Like, I was thinking to myself, it is really crazy that an actress of her stature transitioned into becoming a politician. You know, Ronald Reagan was hardly an Oscar winner, Sonny Bono becoming a congressman. Like, the only thing I could think of recently is, like, what if, like, Hillary Swank just decided to run for Congress?
Iowa or Minnesota or something.
Yeah, I don't know where Hillary Swank is from, but
she seems suitable for Iowa and Minnesota.
She does, and I actually was thinking, like, Hillary Swank might be just the person that America needs to, like, cross our partisan divide. Something about her, I feel like, cosmopolitan liberals would like her, and the whole boys don't cry kind of situation.
And of course the red states were like that whole $1 million baby thing.
Yeah.
But not so much the euthanasia part, I think.
But she just has that corn-fed
thing. I was just going to say corn-fed.
So if Hillary is listening to this, if she ends up running in 2020...
Hillary! Come on, Hillary, you can do it! Hillary 2020!
Very good, Sean, very good. It must have been a real shock to the system when this Shakespearean actress of stage and screen who had achieved international renown decided to throw it all away for a career in politics.
Yes. The thing about Glenda Jackson's career, though, is that, as you'll see from the films that we talk about today, at least in the first 2 episodes, she really came to the height of her fame in the early 70s. By 1988, when she kind of had the idea to run, she really wasn't doing that many great things. The last thing she starred in the early 90s was, I believe, a TV adaptation of The Rainbow, which is in that whole extended Women in Love universe. Don't tell me where it is, but it's in there somewhere.
One of D.H. Lawrence's many orgiastic spewings of words.
And coal mining people.
Yeah, so I guess it's sort of like Glenda had her real moment, right, in the early to mid-70s, where she, in quick succession, won 2 Oscars. And then she was kind of coasting in sort of oddities, things that had some relation to either Ken Russell, who directed her the first time to an Oscar, D.H. Lawrence. Also, didn't she do a lot of, like, weird TV sketch comedy as well?
Yeah, okay, can I just say something? You're saying weird TV sketch comedy. It was Morecambe and Wise,
okay?
Morecambe and Wise were, like, the height of TV primetime sketch comedy Glenda Jackson did a few routines with them. She did, played Cleopatra. She did a version of I Won't Dance, Don't Ask Me. And she did lots of things. She was great. That's another part where I first started seeing Glenda Jackson.
But all of that was post being a two-time Academy Award winner, post, you know, headlining at the Old Vic and Lady Macbeth and Hedda Gabler and God knows
everything,
what.
Everything,
yeah. So that's what I mean. She's an incredibly versatile person in terms of where she's put her acting to use, whether it's in television, comedy, Shakespeare, stage, screen, literary adaptations, contemporary movies, because, like, some of her 70s movies are very much not period pieces. They're not all, you know, 1920s women in love. They're also very contemporary women of the 70s.
Yeah.
And despite all of this range, there's something about Glenda Jackson that always strikes me as the same. Do you know what I mean? Like, we've talked a lot about range in the last few episodes. We talked about it with Julia Roberts. We talked about it with Cate Blanchett. Is Glenda Jackson sort of always the same?
I think she became always the same.
Meaning what?
Ferocious.
Yes. Ferocious, indeed. And she does that thing that, like, frankly, I felt this way when we saw her as King Lear on that fateful night in November 2016.
It was November 8th, 2016.
Yeah, look it up if you don't remember what happened that night. So
I had KFC. That's what I remember.
And you had a very upset stomach on the morning of November 9th.
Indeed.
So we went to see her play King Lear, and there's a way in which Glenda, I hate to say it, she kind of delivers every line in the same way. So if you've watched that YouTube clip of her speech about Margaret Thatcher, then you've also seen her performance as Lear. Oh, reason not the need. Even our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous.
She actually did it way more heavier than that. It was like, reason not the need, even our basest beggars.
Maybe she'd been training with Derek Jacobi.
She didn't take any direction from Deborah Warner, that's for sure.
Yeah, and she's been quite public about that. I mean, that's another thing that I think is wonderful about Glenda Jackson being an 82-year-old woman.
Yeah, you have nothing to lose.
Yeah, she's like back in the public eye, and she's just like happy to mouth off about anything, insult interviewers. That our friend of the podcast, Peter Cook, sent us a wonderful interview from the LA Times in which the interviewer just, like, could barely get a word in edgewise.
Well, you know, Glenda probably has very little time for daft Americans.
She has very little time for anybody. Now,
except Walter Matthau.
Yes, but this is what I mean. Like, she's like, what is the pairing with her and Walter Matthau?
Yeah, so this is the thing about Glenda Jackson's filmography. The films we're going to talk about today are interesting, and some of the films we'll name check are definitely interesting. But there are some films between the years 1975 and 1988 that I have never heard of, never seen.
Hopscotch.
Never had an idea about. Don't know anyone who's seen them. Don't know any of the people involved in making them. Don't know anything about them.
I keep trying to put Glenda into, like, preconceived boxes of other actresses' careers. So in a certain way, she's a bit like Emma Thompson, right? Because she wins an Oscar kind of as an unknown on the international scene for a literary adaptation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah?
British as well.
British. Kind of, she becomes a darling of the American cinema for a brief period of time, but she also has this antic kind of comedy thing going on. I feel like she's also a bit like Judi Dench in some way. Like, do you know how Judi Dench, like, yes, she's a grande dame, but then she also was in that TV sitcom. Like, I feel like Glenda plays, like, high and low.
There's a great ad you can find on YouTube about Glenda talking about how it's so good to give blood. And she gets really woozy at the end of it. I think she might be doing it with either Morecambe or Wise, but don't quote me on
that. Didn't you say that she also wanted to run for mayor of London at one point?
Yeah, I think at one point she wanted to. There's a great, also on YouTube, I'm a treasure trove today, there's a great interview of her on So Graham Norton, where she talks about bringing back the smoking carriages.
That was the main platform of her.
Well, Glenda Jackson loves smoke.
Yeah, that is clear.
From her face.
Now, Sean, you know this from direct experience because you, in the last, what, 3-ish years, have seen Glenda a startling number of times. Yeah. And we're not just talking about seeing her on stage as King Lear.
It's kind of weird that this keeps happening, you know. I've been in the same room and spoken to her and had to walk by her quite a number of times at this point.
Do you want to just enumerate some of them?
Well, I once saw her at BAFTA introducing a screening of Elizabeth R, and then at the end of it you have to file out like right by her, you know? All these grey hairs in the audience are going up and saying, "Hello, Glenda. Do you remember me?" And she goes, "We have to stop meeting like this," and embraces these like very old people. So I remember her going on stage on BAFTA. She looks like she's going to shatter at any point. Okay, she walked up with this raggedy cardigan, this like dirty canvas bag on her shoulder, which she just dropped to the ground beside her seat. It's like you know when an old person falls, they could really hurt themselves. Like, I think that's going to happen to her all the time.
Now, this is the thing that people have to understand about Glenda Jackson's public appearances. It's like, while Jane Fonda is still wearing like couture gowns and like glamoring herself up, Glenda Jackson goes the complete other direction. Like, when she won her Olivier Award for Lear in the photo shoot, isn't she wearing just like a jumper from Marks and Spencer?
It's a dress, in fairness, but yes, it is from Marks and Spencer. Yeah. But in the photos, it's like Ruth Negga in Dior, Cate Blanchett in Balmain, Glenda Jackson in Marks and Spencer's.
Which, for those who aren't in the UK, is a shop that sells clothes as well as groceries.
Yes.
And just so we know, Valentino does not also sell milk and cheese.
But also, Brian, I've got another story to tell you about that.
Yeah.
One time I was on Waterloo Road, ready to cross at the lights. I was there with my bicycle beside me, and I was standing waiting for the lights to change, and I look across, and I see this really tiny, frail old woman, and she's like tonguing her teeth, you know? Do you know what I mean by tonguing your
teeth? Like the kind of person who's been smoking cigarettes all her life and is trying to scrape the tar off of them.
At one point, actually, I thought she had no teeth at all. But when you see Glenda Jackson speak in real life, you're like, wow, your teeth are so bad, they have to be real.
So this frail woman across the street was indeed two-time Oscar winner Glenda Jackson.
But wait, there's more, Brian. Okay?
How was she dressed?
So she was wearing a cardigan again.
Probably the same one.
She was wearing like sweatpants and comfortable shoes and a Tintin t-shirt. You know Tintin?
Yes.
And on her shoulder was the same dirty canvas bag, okay? And I think to myself, you know what? Okay, and anyone who knows me knows I do not talk to famous people, okay?
I'm not a star fucker.
I'm not a star fucker, darling, okay? But I thought to myself, you know what, Sean, you're crossing the road, you can't have a conversation and she won't stop because it's dangerous, okay? So I said to myself, all right, this is my chance. And as I was walking by, I said, "Can't wait for Lear." She looked kind of like what? Like, what the fuck? You know what I mean? And then she looked at me and she then paused and went, "Hope you like it." And that was it. That was it.
She also probably thought to herself, who is this young person who seems to know who I am?
Yeah.
Right? And you're probably the youngest person who's ever recognized Glenda Jackson on the street.
But I think I was also wearing, like, a sleeveless, like, Adidas top and a bicycle helmet.
Oh my goodness. Sean, before we move on to talking about today's film, I just have a question. Like, putting all these pieces together as we describe Glenda, I mean, it's very charming in a certain way, isn't it? Like, you have a lot of respect for her, don't you?
I have a lot of respect for her, yeah, and I had a kind of particularly unhealthy interest in her for quite a while.
Is it partly to do with this kind of down-to-earth quality that, like, she was a politician for Labour, she seems to project this kind of proletarian, no-nonsense persona with her Tintin t-shirts and her, like, ratty cardigans, mm-hmm. yeah, and her chain-smoking?
Well, you know, she became a politician, and I'm quoting her here on this. She said, "I would have done anything I could, anything legal at least, to end Margaret Thatcher's government." And I just found something really, really refreshing about someone of a certain celebrity, I suppose you can say, saying, "I despise what this country is becoming so much that I am going to personally get involved to bring down this demon lady who is dragging us into the ground." And, you know, there's this amazing clip. I've got loads of these, by the way. There's this amazing clip of her on the eve of the 1997 election, where Tony Blair swept to victory, where she finds out that Michael Portillo has lost his seat, and she goes, "Oh my God, Michael Portillo," and she's like, "Thank you, God." No, she doesn't say that, but she does kind of, you know, if anyone can see me now, I'm wringing my hands as if King Lear is ringing them, but looking up into heaven, like, thanking the...
It's like the benevolent version of how you might be if you're holding your deceased daughter Cordelia, but yes, instead you're happy at someone's demise rather than shattered.
So, you know, and that's kind of where I thought, wow, this person is like, she just really doesn't give a damn.
Well, despite having that kind of Radha-trained accent, she is from the north of England, right? The industrial north.
Yeah, I think she's from near the Wirral or something.
Yeah, but that's kind of classic labour, you know, heartland. Yeah.
But, you know, she worked in a chemist shop and she thought, people were like, you should be an actress, you know, you've got a great voice. And she said she wrote to the only drama school that she'd ever heard of. She wrote to Radha and basically said, I'd like to be an actress.
Well, and that's...
I need a scholarship because I'm poor.
That's the thing that's fascinating about her, is like, in her film role, she exudes this sense of superiority a lot of the time. But in her personal life and her public life, she has this kind of earthiness to her.
Yeah.
And that kind of duality is really interesting. The thing for me, and I wonder if this is true for you, I knew who Glenda Jackson was for a very long time, because obviously I studied the history of the Academy Awards, I'd read her name in countless books, I knew Women in Love, A Touch of Class, right? But I'd never actually seen any of her movies until very recently. Mm. I think it was with you that we saw the restored print of Women in Love. I'm pretty sure that was the first time I ever saw Glenda Jackson in anything.
Interesting.
And in the last few years, we've actually seen quite a bit of her on stage, and then we've watched quite a lot of her films. So you, even though you had this fascination with her and this interest in her, had you seen her movies?
No, this is the thing, is that I knew of this person, Glenda Jackson. You know, the way you hear it, you're half listening to the radio, and it's like... joining us now is a Member of Parliament for Amsterdam and Highgate, Glenda Jackson. You know what I mean? That kind of thing. And then I remember one time, I was reading a lot about Ken Russell at the time, and I was on YouTube, and there's a clip of Glenda Jackson introducing the Devils. You can also find it there.
Which she's not in, right?
She's not in. No, it's Vanessa Redgrave. Yeah. And I was like, wait a second. And then, you know, you put two and two together, and it's like, I've been reading Women in Love at one point, I was really into Ken Russell, and her name just kept popping up on all these things. And it was only when I realized that this was the same person that my mind was blown, because I'm like, wait a second, there's a Member of Parliament who has two Oscars. What's that about? But also the fact that she'd worked with Ken Russell just gave her so much more kind of street cred, as it was.
Yeah, and when you finally got around to watching her movies, because you've seen most of the major ones now, as well as sections of Elizabeth R, do you think Glenda lives up to the hype as an actress?
I think she lives up to the hype of Glenda Jackson, the actress.
She has that kind of persona in the way that, say, a Betty Davis does. She's giving you acting, but she's also giving you the Glenda Jackson type.
Yeah. I think the thing is, we all kind of know what the Glenda Jackson type is, but, you know, today's film, Sunday Bloody Sunday, has a lot of beats that she gets to hit.
Yeah.
And actually, when you think about it, it's vulnerable Glenda, it's sad Glenda, it's all these different...
It's sexy Glenda.
It's all these different types of Glenda that aren't actually your preconception.
So that's the film that we're going to talk about today, Sunday Bloody Sunday. I suspect that a lot of listeners, if they've seen any Glenda Jackson, they've probably seen Women in Love, which is really, really worth checking out as a film on its own, for Glenda's Oscar-winning performance, for Alan Bates and Oliver Reed wrestling on a bear rug. And also...
Bear wrestling on a bear rug.
Yeah. And also just for its, like, sexuality. Sexuality, as both Glenda and Julie Andrews would say. you know, it just occurs to me, Glenda Jackson is probably the Member of Parliament who's shown her bare breasts more than any other in history. Would you agree on that?
Yeah, well, you know, actually, it was used against her in her initial campaign.
Really? Why?
Yeah, when she was running for Parliament, the Conservatives were like, is this really the kind of values you want to have in your constituency? And, like, you know, you turn on the television and seeing a film with your MP's tits out. Or rather, seeing Oliver Reed sucking on them.
Well, to be honest, the constituents of Highgate were far more comfortable with that sort of thing than Maggie Thatcher may have let on.
Yeah, if you want to keep your tits in your bra, go to Grantham. Or Barnett.
So, definitely go and seek out Women in Love. I think Sunday Bloody Sunday is a film that is maybe not as well known. So we actually had the very pleasurable experience of seeing a restored print of the film at the BFI maybe about 2 years ago.
You know, this was one of those things that just popped up that we got tickets for. It was like Sunday Bloody Sunday with Q&A with Glenda Jackson. It was like, oh my god, it's an NFT3, my favorite cinema in London, booked the tickets. Okay, we're there. We're like, oh my god. And then, you know, before the film starts, we're chit-chatting, we're looking around, and then we see her, and it's like, oh my god, she's here. She's here, like, she
just
was
sitting among the plebs.
She sat down and watched it, and I was like, oh my god, she's watching it. Because, can I just say, there's one thing about watching a new film that you're in.
Even most stars don't do that. I feel like they sit in the green room and they swill champagne and they, you know, or they come in late in their car. But Glenda was just sitting there with her fucking canvas bag watching the movie.
Yeah, it was one of the most incredible things I've ever seen, because you're watching someone look at themselves from, God, like 40-something years ago, seeing your breasts, seeing your body, seeing your naked body, and you sitting there, not like that anymore.
It's amazing.
It must be so weird.
Well, and she didn't seem fazed by it, although some of the responses in the Q&A were so funny, like things that she both remembered and didn't remember.
She said things like, that scene in the headdress, I have no recollection of that, no memory. I don't remember that saying at all.
Okay, so Sunday Bloody Sunday is very, very much a film of its time. I'm sure it seemed quite groundbreaking and quite taboo-busting in 1971. And to a certain degree, a way in which the central relationships of the movie are presented still feels relatively taboo-breaking today.
Yeah, right? Well, we should say it's a film about bisexuality.
Yeah, it's a film about a love triangle. At the center is a bohemian bisexual artist played by the actor Murray Head, who's a kind of a young hippie type with kind of a mop top of hair.
Not a good look, if you ask me.
It's funny, everybody seems to think he's the sexiest thing on two legs. He's cute enough.
He's cute enough.
But there have been definitely sexier hippies that I've seen in
for
movies.
Sure.
And particularly when the two people who are just smitten with him are not only Glenda Jackson, but also Peter Finch, who are both kind of very commanding performers, and they are just gaga for this one man.
Mm.
So basically it's a movie about this love triangle. It takes place sort of over like 1 week of time
exactly,
in London during the 1970s. As we hear on the radio that mentions this all the time, there's an economic crisis going on.
The economic crisis. And the cabinet has been in almost continuous session at 10 Downing Street. It broke up an hour ago. At one point, TUC leaders, also meeting to discuss the emergency, were called in by the Prime Minister. They were there for 2 hours. And our political editor understands that there were some acrimonious exchanges.
This would be the kind of period of time, right? With
lots of union struggles.
Yeah, union struggles, all of that, which would eventually lead to Margaret Thatcher's rise by the end of the 70s. So it's a time of malaise for Britain. And you get the sense that all of that malaise is kind of permeating everybody's sense of the future in this movie. Mm. And a kind of breakdown of values, right? Like, so that all the traditional ways that people viewed marriage and relationships and family and women's roles and men's roles, they've all been cast aside and thrown away, but people are a little bit unsure as to whether they can make new rules that are going to be effective. So it's a really, really fascinating movie. We've now seen it twice, once in this Q&A, and then we rewatched it for this episode.
Yeah, my question is, Brian, what kind of film is it? Is it a social satire? Is it a straight-up drama? What is it?
Well, I definitely wouldn't call it a satire. It has moments of humor, but I think ultimately it has a kind of strain of melancholy and regret and ruefulness. I think I said to you this time when we were watching it, you know, in a lot of ways, this is the kind of movie that you could imagine being based on a Booker Prize-winning novel.
Exactly.
Yeah? Because we're introduced to all the central characters. They're unified by this artist, Bob Elkin, who's played by Murray Head. He's the kind of one who unites them all together. But you can almost imagine, like, a section of the book told from Glenda's character's perspective, and then a section of the book told from Peter Finch's perspective, you know, in the way that Henry James might do it, or even...
And then a section where it's told from the third person.
Yeah. Or, you know, Faulkner does this kind of thing, even Zadie Smith in, like, NW. It's a kind of classic novelistic centering of consciousness. But also, I think the reason it feels novelistic is because, like, not a lot happens. Like, for a movie that's called Sunday Bloody Sunday, you kind of think it's going to have, I don't know, violence. And there is one memorable act of violence that occurs, but it kind of occurs sort of halfway through the film, and it's not as if any person dies or anything. Do you know what I mean? But it's just the kind of, like, overall sense that what we're going to see is people who are not entirely satisfied, not entirely happy in all these domestic spaces, and relationships are going to be put under strain and, like, pulled apart. I don't know if we're making it sound very fun or not. I would say no. it's a really interesting movie to watch.
But the thing is, Brian, a lot of films in the early 70s weren't particularly fun. They were experimental in terms of narrative framing. It had a whole new wave of actors and actresses who, you know, didn't speak with that kind of affectation that we were used to. There was a lot more filming on location. Like, and this is a prime example of that, because John Schlesinger, was he American?
No, I think he's British.
Okay, but, I mean, Midnight Cowboy is very much an American film.
Yeah, so he directed Julie Christie in Darling, which was the kind of 60s version of this, where she's, like, the it girl of the swinging 60s. Midnight Cowboy, of course, with John Voight and Dustin Hoffman. Again, kind of, like, breaking sexual taboos. So he had this history of making plot lines that were sort of about new sexual mores, I guess you could say. I find all of those Schlesinger movies, including Sunday Bloody Sunday, to be a bit like looking at these people through, like, a microscope. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? Like saying, oh, look at these bisexuals rewriting the rules. Oh, look how comfortable everyone is with the fact that they're sharing this man between men and women. But you can kind of see a bit of a reserve on the part of both Schlesinger as the director and Penelope Gilliatt, the screenwriter, kind of saying, like, but can they?
Yeah, it's more
can like, they really be as progressive as they think they are?
It's a bit like more like a fish tank or something, you know?
Yeah, and that's what I mean. Like, it's a weirdly conservative gaze cast upon people who are trying to be very progressive. Does that make sense?
I think it's a progressive intent with conservative outcomes.
Interesting. I mean, it's actually a really brilliant premise as the start of the film. Again, it feels very novelistic. Murray Head and Glenda Jackson know each other already, but they're coming together for this first weekend of the movie's timeline to do what?
Well, they're house-sitting and babysitting at the same time.
Just as we were doing last episode in Worthing, although we didn't have to deal with any obnoxious children and a dog.
Exactly.
Who are they house-sitting for?
She stays with this family. This is where I think the film is a satire, or just a straight-up weird comedy, because it, tonally, it's really weird. Weird here. So Glenda is minding the children of this beyond liberal, progressive, freewheeling, hippy-dippy, you know, frou-frou bullshitters.
Well, and the reason why the father and mother are going away is because they've taken up some kind of African dissident intellectual as their, like, protege, and they're taking him off to a conference to, like, deliver a speech. So Glenda has to take care of their children.
The children who cannot behave themselves.
No, they also have no respect for boundaries of any kind.
They smoke marijuana.
Well, not only do they smoke marijuana, but they know exactly where Mummy and Daddy keep it.
Are you children smoking pot?
Are you bourgeois?
I don't mind, but does Mummy know?
They keep it at the back of the record so we know where it is. Behind Tristan and Solva.
They're sort of the precursors to that family in Hannah that we talked about in the other podcast, you know. Parents who are trying to be so hip with their kids.
Yeah, intellectually hip. Yeah.
They're also, the children are dressed in these kind of weird smocks all the time.
Well, that I do approve of.
You do?
Yes, yeah. You know I love a smock.
But, like, how do you think of this as a setup for a film? So we have two unmarried people, Glenda, who plays Alex Greville, and Bob Elkin, Murray Head. They want to have a weekend together for a kind of fuckfest, I guess you could
say. Well, I don't think it's a fuckfest. Well, I just think it's a chance encounter for them to enjoy their bodies and each other in a different environment.
Yeah, in a nice big bed, in a nice big house, but they also have to deal with all these kids.
Yes.
So it's a kind of weird setup where these two people who are definitely not playing the typical domestic game, yeah, they're doing their, oh, we're hip, we're just fucking each other, you know, we have our own independent lives, but they're surrounded by all the trappings of middle-class domesticity and dealing with kids and dogs.
Yeah. And then at one point, you know, Murray Head says, I'm just gonna go into town for a bit. And we're like, oh? And she says, you're not going to see someone with the initials D-A, are you?
And who's D-A?
It's the first two letters of Daniel. Daniel Hirsch, Dr. Daniel Hirsch, who is... He seems to be the older lover of Murray Head, a doctor. And I keep thinking it's one particular part of Islington that he's at. I have these flashpoints, but it's not. We think it's somewhere in lovely West London.
We've met him already. We've met Glenda already. But what we discover is that Glenda knows absolutely everything about the fact that Murray also sleeps with Peter Finch.
Yes.
I mean, how did you feel about Murray Head's behavior here? Because he's come down to stay with her with the kids, and then as soon as the kids start getting in their hair, making it hard for them to have any alone time and dealing with them, he's just like, oh, you know what? I'm going to go off to see my other lover, my homosexual lover, and leave you here. That is really shitty behavior.
It is really shitty behavior, but you know, it's one of those situations where, like, I'm so cool with everything that I'm not allowed to get upset or right. contest this.
Glenda kind of...
Which is a thing that people are still doing today.
Yeah, but because Glenda is down with this whole free love thing and she's a feminist and, you know, she basically just has to accept it. Although you can sense through her solitary looking at Murray Head and her resentment... And then that wonderful scene where she's made fudge at home in the yeah. kitchen. Yeah, do you want to describe that?
Glenda's reading a book, kind of silently sobbing. And the girl comes over and first of all she's like, well, you've eaten all of it. And Glenda's like, it was my idea. Me who made it. There's plenty more of it. So there.
And then the girl says something like, has Bob walked out on you? And that's why you're overeating, to compensate for it.
And it's like all these points where it's like, oh my god, these children and their value system.
But I mean, Glenda is literally, she's got tears going down her face. And this is like one
eating
of the...
Eating fudge.
Yeah, eating fudge. And this is one of the points where we have to say, okay, she's a liberated woman, but does she like what liberation actually means? In some ways, she still has to conform to the normal rules because he's dumped her with the kids and the house and the food and the cooking while he's gone off to fuck around. So well, how liberated is liberation?
Don't go on at me like some possessive wife.
I should never have said yes to this weekend.
Okay, I know you're not getting enough of me, but you're getting all there is.
Perhaps you're spreading yourself a little thin.
Well, this is actually the conservative aspect of the film, where it's one of those things where it's like, oh yes, you're liberated, but are you happy? Do you have company? You have all these belief systems and ideals, but you have nothing to show for it.
Well, we haven't said much about Glenda's life when she's not house-sitting. So Alex Greville, who is she?
We're thinking she lives in Shoreditch or somewhere, because she has this big, spacious loft apartment that I think we're probably supposed to think, oh, look how grubby it is.
Yeah, although we're thinking, look at the square feet of that.
Oh my god.
It's probably on a canal.
Exactly.
You were taken by... She's always a bit late, and they make a joke about the late Alex Greville. So she has to rush from this presumably East London warehouse down to meet the family. And she's in such a rush that she has a very funny way of making a drink for herself.
Oh yeah, she puts instant coffee in a cup and puts hot water from the tap onto it.
And then like sips it and goes, eh! You quite like that. Did that remind you of you in some way?
It reminded me a little bit. I've never done that, but the amount of times where I'm running around with a cup, like I'm ready to go and I just like take a few mouthfuls of something and just leave it on the toilet or something, or leave it, you know, by the door or, you know, wherever. I do feel kind of solidarity.
You also have a habit of, when in a real rush and needing to eat, just eating sardines over the sink.
Yeah, I eat sardines over the sink.
Not even a plate. Right
out of the can. So you put a bit of ketchup on them.
You and Alex Greville would fit right in together. So yeah. She's divorced, right?
She is divorced.
She's divorced, and she works in some kind of soulless job in, like, a recruiting agency or something, we learned. She kind of is helping businessmen find jobs in a time when there are very few jobs to be had.
You know, now that I think about it, actually, it's kind of interesting that she has this, you know, apparent bohemian life, but actually, her job is pretty boring.
Yeah, that's
pretty
true.
Pretty steadfast and typical.
And, you know, the thing that links her and Hirsch and Murray Head is another vestige of the 70s, which is this answering service.
Oh, I love this. This is a great plot device.
Yeah, and this is kind of how the whole movie is introduced, right? Because we kind of follow the telephone wires as each of them is trying to call Murray Head and we get this connection. And we keep seeing the same answering service operator, who's this kind of busybody woman who seems to be picking up on the fact that this man and this woman are always trying to call this one guy, and has clearly picked up on the fact that there's a love triangle.
Yeah, has Mr. Elkin left any messages? You know, both of them say that.
And then they say things like, "Will you be in, Miss Greville?" "Oh no, but I will be for Mr. Elkin. Tell him to ring twice so that I know it's him."
It's so weird. It's kind of a weird concept.
Yeah, just think about the information that those operators would have had.
Do you know the thing is, okay? You know, when we watch a film from 1955, which is only 16 years prior to Sunday Bloody Sunday, or a Betty Davis thing, or even like, you know, Whatever Happened to Baby Jane, which is only about less than 8 years before this, they feel so old, okay? Because the world is still unfamiliar to us. But when you see something like Sunday Bloody Sunday, and you know that it's on, like I said earlier, that it's on location, like, we had this moment where we were watching her drive down Waterloo Bridge, and we were like, well, if she's going that way, then she must have actually lived in East London. That, like, it's kind of weird to think, I recognize this world, and it's familiar to me, but it's also really different.
Well, I know exactly what you mean, and partially I think that's because all those people from those earlier movies, Betty Davis and whoever, they're all dead, but Glenda's still around. There's a link between the people who made those films and the present day. And so we don't always think of those 70s movies as period pieces.
But they are now.
They are now, and they're period pieces not just in terms of the costumes and the economic circumstances, but also just the questions that people are dealing with. And, like, I think the questions of sexuality and feminism and marriage are very much being dissected in this movie in a way that really probably felt very current and very provocative in 1971, and feels slightly curdled to me today in a certain way. So, over the course of the days that we watch in the film, Murray Head kind of hops back and forth between being with Peter Finch and being with Glenda Jackson. And it has to be said that the interactions he has with Peter Finch are really openly physical, right? Yeah. Like, he shows up at Dr. Hirsch's flat, they kiss full on in the lips, it's right on a close-up. They get into bed together, they disrobe.
There's beautiful classical music playing over these scenes.
Yeah, and similarly, Glenda also sees him showering, and she kind of ogles him in the shower with his, like, cute little buns and, like, glistening with droplets of water, you know. Both of them are clearly infatuated with this man, and the sexuality of it is clearly the strongest desire. They put up with a lot of shit from this guy, who basically, I mean, he's an artist, and, like, do you want to describe the kind of art he makes? This is another very period detail.
Yeah, he makes these huge installations that involve, like, different colored liquids, you know, undulating up and down tubes.
Yeah, they're sort of like very sophisticated lava lamps. He also does these weird spirograph things where the pen is drawing these kind of crazy repeated patterns, but it's not even done by his own hand. It's done through a machine, you know? Like, if this was a Woody Allen movie, do you know that scene in Manhattan where he and Diane Keaton go to MoMA and they just, like, look at all the weird sculpture and they kind of make fun of it?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, that's what I feel like is being satirized here as well. It's conceptual art, it's op art, you know, it's casting this kind of withering gaze at the kind of emptiness of the Murray Head character, that he makes this stuff and he sells it quite lucratively, they mention, to American business people. So I think we're not really supposed to think Murray Head is a very good character.
No, I also don't think this film villainizes him at all, which is the thing that film was doing to any kind of queer characters at this point.
You know, he's not a queer villain, he's just a kind of callow, exploitative man.
Well, here's the thing. This is why I found him very believable. It's not an accurate portrayal of a bisexual. It's the accurate portrayal of someone who knows that people are into him. The thing about this film is that it actually doesn't really do wonders for the bisexual characters. It doesn't portray them as, like, maniacal villains. It just portrays this particular guy as wanting a bit of everything.
So he leaves Daniel wanting more and goes back to Glenda, who has been dealing with the kids. There's a power cut in the house. She's extremely annoyed with him. Now here comes the man to deal with all the manly things like circuit breakers and all that stuff. You know, you can tell that Glenda is fundamentally struggling with the fact that she grew up in one world, the world of her parents, and she wants to have left that behind, but she finds herself wanting and needing the same things from a man that she intellectually feels she doesn't need, yeah?
Yeah.
The biggest kind of disaster happens the next day, on the Sunday of this weekend, when they all go to the park in Greenwich. And at first it's all lovely and the kids are running around and playing and you think, oh look, they're playing at being a happy family, right? Until disaster strikes. Of course, disaster only strikes after a young Daniel Day-Lewis has crossed the screen.
Yeah, do you know what? This time I kept my eyes peeled. It really is a blink and you miss it thing. This is Daniel Day-Lewis's first film where he plays a young vandal. You get that side profile, which is 100%.
It's the nose, yeah, that gives it away.
But it is, like, it's a flash.
How old is he? He must be like 15?
Oh, I'd say so, yeah.
Yeah, but that comes right before the real act of violence that makes this a bloody Sunday.
Yes, so as the little, you know, bratty girl is running across the road, a car drives out in front of them. We see this vehicle screech to a halt and hit something, but it's not the girl who's killed, it's the dog, the family hound, and this truck, which is carrying potatoes, then just dots them all over the road in a complete disaster.
And it's really, even though it's just a scene of a dog getting hit by a car, which it could have been much grislier and much worse, it has this emotional weight to it, right? Glenda and Murray Head are both really, really upset, and Glenda yells at the girl. She says, "You're a naughty girl! How many times have you been told not to run across the road?" And believe me, if Glenda Jackson yells at you, you feel it.
You feel it, yeah.
But you can sense that they both feel their anger at the girl and their dismay is also about them thinking, we've not been able to live up to the responsibility that we were given, which is the responsibility to mind these kids and this dog, but also the responsibility to be kind of adults, which I think, like, fundamentally they both, in their heart of hearts, don't think they really are or can be.
Yeah, very interesting.
In the way that the old way of thinking of an adult as a reliable person would have you believe. Strangely enough, when they get back to the house, the friends who have gone off on their trip come back. They're not all that upset about the dog or upset about the fact that the little girl herself might have almost been killed. They're just kind of blasé going back into their life. I actually, when we rewatch the movie now, I had thought in my memory that it kind of ended soon after that. But no, a whole other week goes by. A week in which Glenda goes back to her Shoreditch flat. Peter Finch is still going around. I mean, he has, like, talk about, like, homosexuals presented as relatively pathetic.
Yeah, he gets a bit of a short straw, doesn't he?
I mean, yeah, because he just kind of goes around driving and picking up one-night stands and tricks and never kind of getting fully satisfied.
Are we going back to your place, then?
No, we're not. I'm dropping you off. On the way, I'll call at a chemist and get you a painkiller for that.
You're not much of a bleeding driver, are you? Doctor. Are you in love?
Probably.
Having to go to the synagogue for a bar mitzvah and having all his Jewish relatives say, "When are you going to get married, Daniel?" and not being able to talk about the person that he truly loves, right? Mm. And I'm sure there were many, many people in that situation at that time. But it is a kind of sad sack kind of performance of a homosexual.
Well, the film is affected with an entire malaise. Like, everybody gets it. You know, he's just doubly unfortunate, I suppose.
Glenda gets a little bit of a comeuppance on Murray Head. So after this difficult weekend that's not turned out the way that they wanted it to be, she does two things. The first is that she goes and visits her family. We've already seen a couple of flashbacks to Glenda as a little girl.
Yeah. Not so much flashbacks as they are kind of like dream within a dream, hallucinogenic moments.
Yeah, you liked this bit. I have to say, this was the most on-the-nose Freudian stuff for me.
No, this kind of stuff I really love. I love when there's like abstract flashbacks in
films. So this is like a flashback to like her childhood in the Blitz. she's watching the kids that she's minding. She's thinking about how close they came to danger. And then we're brought back to her childhood, which is during World War II, with quite posh parents. Uh-huh. Yeah?
At first I thought this was a fantasy, you know, that she kind of grew up in some different world. Because Daddy kisses her goodbye, and then we see her watching him get on his bicycle, and then we see her running through the streets saying, "Daddy's gas mask, he's not wearing his gas mask."
And I guess, what are we supposed to make of that as a memory? It's like, the dangers that that generation faced were the existential threat of fascism and complete destruction.
Yeah.
The dangers that this generation faces is what? Like,
well, being on the dole and having a difficult love life.
Yeah.
The thing is, though, you know what? Like, the moment we get into these arguments, it's always kind of like the older generation before you had so much more to do and stuff. But yeah, I mean, I think in this particular context, you're framing it in these two extremes. It's like, one is war and outright destruction. Two is the glory of the NHS.
She has an interesting conversation when she goes to visit her family, because they clearly pick up on the fact that she's not in a good place. She's not very happy. She's having trouble with her love life. She learns that her parents have been having regular lunches with her ex-husband. And they're like, "We like him. He's rather pleasant." You know, the implication being that she's not very pleasant. Her mother is played by Peggy Ashcroft.
Dame Peggy Ashcroft.
Yes.
Yeah, so it's one of those kind of cameos that kind of lasts with you and has its own kind of impactful consequence on the film. Glenda has kind of a negative view on what the family is and how their lives are things that she is railing against. Okay, so when Glenda goes around to her family home and she has the meal, and I gotta say, the setting that she's in is completely in contrast to the bohemian life in the house that she's just been in. If anything, this is a part of the film that feels most like a set in the traditional sense. You know, it's all brown mahogany bookshelves. And, you know, her father is busy squirreling away, doing his own thing in his office. Her mother is, you know, making the coffee. And Glenda's kind of like, you know, how can you do this? How can you just be a family for 1 hour a week on a Sunday? And she's kind of railing against this idea of what the family, traditional family, is. And you kind of would expect the mother to be kind of like critical of her daughter's life. But she says, "Oh, darling, you're obviously in a funk because of some lover that you're having at the moment." And Glenda kind of explains what's happening, and her mother's like, "Oh, you know, I've always liked hippies. You know, they hate business and competition. Kind of makes them so fun to be around."
And it's interesting because Glenda kind of basically says to her mother, "I just want to have the whole thing. I don't want to feel like I have to play this one role at one time and another role at the other time. Can't you have it all?" Which I guess is the fundamental predicament of second wave feminism, right? And the mother looks at her and says, "There is no whole thing, darling. You just have to make it work."
Yeah.
Which is very kind Tim of like Gunn, isn't Tim it? Gunn, yeah.
But it's true, though, you know. You can have all the philosophy you want, or critical theory, but when it comes down to it, doing the role, it's like there is no whole thing. You cannot have it all, you know?
Well, it's also the messiness of human emotions versus the abstract ideas of politics and gender roles, yeah? Mm. So Glenda gets her own back a bit when she has a one-night stand with a man that she's met through her recruitment job, who is married and is looking for work, and they flirt over Glenda's desk, and then she takes him home. And then for the first time, the roles are reversed, because she's had a kind of pleasant sexual encounter with a man, you know, older than her. And who rings on the answering service but Murray Head?
But Murray Head, Mr. Elgin,
who is desperate to come over and see her. And you can see in Glenda's face that at first she's like, "Oh, shit, I don't want Bob coming over while George is in bed with me." And then she thinks, you know, why not? That's what he does to me.
Yeah.
So how did you feel about that whole scene and that kind of thread?
Well, you know, this is actually a testament to Glenda and how one is as an actor. Because, you know, someone said if you're trying to play drunk, you're trying to play not being drunk. And so Glenda is playing cool and, you know, easy breezy cover girl, but actually you know that she's finding this whole thing to be artificial and that she's just kind of playing by the rule book that Murray Head uses, which is, oh, everything's fine, everything's cool. This is George, this is Bob, you know? It's all so chill.
And
but
she's,
it's not,
she's,
it never is.
Well, she's reveling in the fact that she gets to exert the same power over him and to watch him be uncomfortable with it, yeah? And this is where the kind of lie of male sexuality is revealed, that, like, the rules are all well and good when he's the one who gets to benefit from them, but when he wants sex and he wants her to be his property, he's not happy when she's being shared around. And this is the kind of point where it all comes to a head, no pun intended, because Murray Head is debating whether he's going to go off to America. There's one very on-the-nose scene where he's making art in the shape of a pound sign, like pound sterling, and turns it into a design, and you're like, okay, so this is all he cares about, is the profit motive. And Glenda really has to face a choice. Okay, is she going to keep pining away after him when he goes off to America? Meanwhile, Peter Finch is thinking, I'll seduce Murray Head by taking him on a romantic motoring trip through Italy. And of course, Murray Head doesn't want anything to do with either of them, because he's going to go off to America and he's going to bonk every man and woman, you know, from
Boston and
Boston to San Francisco.
Let's pick two obscure places.
From
Portland, Maine to Portland, Oregon.
Very good, Sean. From sea to shining sea.
And through those amber fields of grain.
Waves of grain.
Amber waves of grain.
You should know that. That's the name of Julianne Moore. Yeah. So Glenda, finally, like, to be honest, she's been quite passive and feminine in relation to Murray Head through most of this movie. You feel that she's kind of like suppressing some of her rage. She finally has a tirade to him, saying, I'm always making do and shutting up and changing myself. Well, I don't want to play by these rules.
Alex. Me being careful not to ask you about Daniel. Daniel not getting answers from you because you're here. I've had this business. Anything is better than nothing. There are times when nothing has to be better than anything.
And you suddenly see that she's going to stand up for herself. She's going to, you know, argue for a new life, and she's going to cut Murray Head loose. So that really is what this whole week that we follow is about. Is about a woman understanding that this arrangement is not going very well for her. He also says goodbye to Peter Finch, and he goes off to America. And our two other points of the triangle are kind of left, a bit bereft, a bit lost and not knowing what to do. And then they finally run into each other for the first time.
The very end of the film, back in that, this weird family seems to be the nucleus for everything, because they know Bob, they know Glenda, and they know Dr. Hirsch, you know?
Peter Finch has been having Sunday lunch with them. Glenda hadn't realized that he was also invited, so she's been just like strolling around in the park outside, and they have a brief exchange as Finch is exiting the lunch. They both kind of acknowledge that they both were in love with this guy, Murray Head. He's left both of them, he's gone off. And I think they kind of tacitly agree, you know what, we probably are better off. We get a bit of voiceover from Glenda. And then, in the very last scene of the film, Peter Finch is back in his well-appointed apartment with the sculpture that Murray Head has made kind of glistening in the lawn. And he stares straight at the camera and delivers a monologue about how he feels.
Yeah.
It's a very weird kind of anti-naturalistic note for the film to end on.
Yeah.
And it's suffused with the same kind of sad sack regret of like, maybe I am better off, but I also still miss him and I feel sad.
No. I want his company, and they say, what's half a loaf? You're well shot of him. And I say, I know that. But I miss him. That's all. And they say, he never made you happy. And I say, but I am happy, apart from missing him.
He also has this interesting line where he says, when you're a kid, you can't wait to grow up and get out into the world, and then it's not what you expected.
Yeah.
I feel like this movie is I feel like this movie is very much about what does it mean to be grown up?
Yeah.
You know? And the way in which people who are chronologically adults don't feel that they fully fit into the roles and responsibilities of being adult.
Isn't it a film very much about playing different roles? So Dr. Hirsch plays the the stalwart medical professional doling out advice to crying housewives.
He also plays the mensch, who's a good upstanding Jewish boy to his father and aunts and uncles when he goes to the bar mitzvah.
Yeah, he plays the purple cravat wearing a genteel homosexual at the party.
Yeah.
Glenda is the, you know, office frau. And then she's the, you know, East London dwelling bohemian. And even that family, you know, you feel that family are so determined to keep this mask on, keep the role up. I think looking at that family, you think that, you know, they've had these good costumes on for so long that they're just believing the parts now.
It's interesting because the only person who seems to be able to slip and slide and move between all these roles is the young person, Murray Head. Yeah. And I think the reason is, the way the movie depicts it, is because he has no fixed identity underneath at all.
And he has no consequence. He's no history.
He has no values. He has no soul. Whereas Glenda and Peter Finch, they know that they're supposed to be able to shift roles and be blasé and not care, but their emotions are too thumping at their chest, you know, underneath, that makes it very difficult for them to do that without feeling some kind of pain, you know? It's a movie that kind of ends on a upbeat for Glenda and a bit of a downbeat for Peter Finch, right? Glenda at least has stood up to him, and you sense, okay, maybe she's not going to be with this man, maybe she's not going to be with any man, but she's learned some things about being an independent woman. Whereas Peter Finch, you just feel like he's going to fall in love with the next bit of trade that he happens to run into on the street, and he's just going to keep being a bit miserable and pathetic.
Mm. Yeah? Would you recommend this film?
I would definitely recommend it. I mean, it's filmed beautifully, it's beautifully edited, and all of the central performances are really, really interesting. I have, I guess, as you can tell from what I'm saying, some political reservations about it. I don't tend to like movies that say people who try to break traditional roles always end up reverting to traditional emotions. Call me utopian, but I do like to think that if you are mature and reasonable and communicative, you can create relationships that don't conform to the values of your parents. I just believe that.
Who are you talking about, Brian?
Oh, I'm just talking about, you know, people in the world.
People who need people, and other people and other people as well. the thing is, I actually don't think the film is overtly political, okay? I think if you boil this down to what it is, it's a story about three people trying to be happy and comfortable and successful.
Yeah, but it's definitely a zeitgeist film.
No, let me correct that. It's about two people who want to be happy.
And how do you feel about Glenda's performance? Because in some ways, it's one of the most subtle of the performances that we've ever seen Glenda do. Like, she seems most like a real person in this movie, even more so than in Women in Love, you know?
Well, yeah.
Yeah, even more so than in any of the other movies we've watched. She's not a queen. She's not pontificating all the time. She's actually quite mellow and subdued and sad a lot of the time.
She's also not a member of an insane asylum performing for the Marquis de Sade.
So Sunday Bloody Sunday, it's a really interesting period piece that shows you a bit of what Glenda can do when she's turning on the dramatic emotional waterworks.
Yeah. So last thing, how many films do you think there are where a Best Actor nominee and a Best Actress nominee share next to no time together in the film? Do you think this is holds the record for shortest amount of time for lead acting nominees to be in a scene together?
That's probably true. It's interesting. It's not an Oscar statistic I've ever thought of before. But you're right. It's very, very peculiar. Because they're the leads, but they never really interact until that last bit at the end. Yeah, in all of those reasons, it makes it a fascinating movie that people should seek out. Anyone interested in gender roles, feminism, identity, sexuality, the 70s, British filmmaking.
Unions.
No. If you want unions, watch Reds. Okay, but speaking of unions, ill-fated unions, we have another movie that we're coming up in our second installment. I'm going to tell you, ladies and gentlemen, whether you're a Glenda fan, a Glenda stan, this next installment is going to be something well worth listening to. I think, Sean, before we even started this podcast,
I think this was one of the reasons we wanted to do
this. This was one of the reasons we wanted to do this in the first place. We said, you know what? We have so many thoughts, so many things to say about this bizarre, weird, and actually quite bad film.
Yeah.
that we just want to record it and share it with the world. And thus, Broad Appeal was born. What on earth are we talking about, ladies and gentlemen?
Can I tell them?
Don't tell them entirely, just touch upon it.
Yes, I'll just give you a mere touch of something. How's that, darling?
Very classy. If you haven't figured it out, you could always see us teasing the next episode at our Twitter page, which is at Broad Appeal Pod.
And don't forget to follow us at Sean McGovern X and at BA Mullinspeak. And if you really want to do something, you can leave us a rating or review on iTunes.
And please, you know, I know you might like other podcasts and you've left them ratings and reviews, but we're very open-minded. You know, we're all about polyamory. So if you like other podcasts, you can like us as well, and you can give everybody 5 stars, right?
Everybody gets 5 stars.
Yes.
Oh, Brian, now that you've mentioned polyamory, I've just lost all interest.
Isn't that just like a man?
Goodbye.